What is a teacher? A teacher is not necessarily someone who sits in front of a group of people, has a topic, imparts that topic, and then has Q&A. That's actually a pretty kind of limited model or limited opportunity for teaching.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Wisdom Seed Podcast. I'm Bill Moriarty. So for this one, me and a few other folks at the Wisdom Seat are now starting to become meditation instructors and teachers and sharing our experience with others. And it's so crucial to me to know how to approach this correctly. So I talked to my meditation instructor, Michael Carroll, who's also my friend, who's also one of the founders of the Wisdom Seat, and he's been doing this for 45 years. So I went to him with a bunch of questions. What even is a meditation instructor? How's this different than a Buddhist teacher? What is a lineage holder? How does he prepare for talks? We went over all these topics, a lot of good answers from Michael. And a thing to look out for is his emphasis on orchestrating insight as opposed to someone who just imparts information. So this was really beneficial for me personally, and I hope it's beneficial for you too. Enjoy. So I think you've been teaching since you were in your early 20s.
Let me see. I think the very first time I ever taught Dharma was in 1978. So I don't know, that's 25 years old. But it was just as an assistant teacher. I was being trained as a teacher. So I didn't like teach a whole course. I was working with Frank Berliner, actually, and Frank was the teacher and I was the assistant teacher. And then he said, okay, your job is to teach this one topic. And that happened for the very first time, I think 1978.
Well, even there, let's roll back. Why were you assistant teacher? Did you want to be?
No, in order to be a teacher in Trungpa Rinpoche's world, you needed to go through a process. And it had to do with first being an assistant teacher and sort of working with someone as a kind of an apprentice, you know, kind of thing. Then also you had to go to actually training where you would go and learn ground path fruition. You would then role play, you get feedback. The teacher would then, you know, in a group, and then the teacher almost invariably said, well, you can move on and teach now. And there you had to do it. There were levels. I think I've gone to 3 training as a teacher over the years, 3 formal go away for, you know, 4 or 5 days kind of thing. And so Rinpoche put in an infrastructure, for learning. It wasn't all that formal, but it was really helpful.
But did you want to do that? Like, was it like, who wants to sign up? Or was someone saying, you are doing this?
Oh, no, I don't think anyone said, oh, you're special or you should be a teacher. I think part of it is, I think, In the Buddhist tradition, the idea of imparting your experience to others is kind of part of the Bodhisattva vow, or a natural expression of following the path. Does it mean that you have to sit up in front of a crowd of people and impart information? No. I think that's an important thing that maybe we can get into about what is a teacher. A teacher is not necessarily someone who sits in front of a group of people, has a topic, imparts that topic, and then has Q&A. That's actually a pretty kind of limited model or a limited opportunity for teaching. But nonetheless, that's very traditional. And, I also have a master's degree in curriculum design and adult education. And I did a lot of training design on Wall Street and elsewhere. So, I mean, it's not like I don't formally know about education as well, particularly adult education.
Okay. So were you as good at it as you are now?
That's very kind of you, sir, saying that I'm a good teacher. I enjoy, to me, sharing ideas with people and provoking their wisdom and learning from them, because I don't see my role as a teacher as just imparting stuff. I see it as orchestrating wisdom. And I've been in the room with a lot of smart people, including you, And just orchestrating the wisdom of people has always fascinated me. When I was on Wall Street, we had to do quality circles. That was how they were shifting back office culture from just executing paper transactions to provoking people to think about improving process, right? And quality circles was a big thing. And I would train people in quality circles. Well, quality circles, the very definition of that is those people know the answer, not you. It's how do you get them to get the answer out? So that I think is very Buddhist, frankly. That people's wisdom is inherent. Mm-hmm. And how do you provoke it, evoke it, nourish it, enrich it, tease it, that kind of thing, play with it. I think that's a major part of being a good teacher.
Was that part of also teacher training?
Yeah, I think so. I think the way they would frame it back then is how do you do Q&A well?
Okay.
It's very kind of, okay, you got to impart the teachings, got to do Q&A. This was a very kind of nascent organization in the 70s. Yeah. Trungpa Rinpoche was just beginning to produce teachers. So it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was very sophisticated, but, very structured well, and, it worked well, and we took it seriously and worked at it.
Yeah, something I love seeing in some of the really good Buddhist lecture Q&As is someone will ask a question, and the teacher will answer the real question.
Yeah.
That isn't exact, that a person didn't even really know they were asking. Right. That seems very skillful.
Well, I was just saying this earlier that someone told me this. I was not there when Trungpa Rinpoche said this, but someone told me that he said it. He said, I really listen. When I sit down, I really listen with people, but I don't listen to their words that much. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's the point you were making.
Mm-hmm. Did you have were there any early challenges or pivotal moments when you were starting teaching that you influenced how you continued after that?
Challenges?
Interesting. Yeah, it could be either way. It could be either that didn't land like I thought, or it could be the other way. This seems to be more helpful than I thought it was going to be.
Well, I can honestly say, I don't think I've ever been in a situation teaching, whether it's Dharma or just, conventional notions, where the circumstances somehow go awry. Generally speaking, it's kind of like dancing. If you miss a beat, it's okay, but you dance. It's like, oh, I like dancing. And you don't go, is there any time when dancing was really hard? And no, you dance. It's kind of normal. But I should say, as I'm getting older, I over-prepare for my talks. And I don't know why. I do a lot of study, a lot of reading, probably because I've been introduced to so many teachers and so many interesting ideas that I over-prepare. And I get really frustrated. It's to a point where I go,
frustrated with yourself?
Yeah. I'm like, why am I doing this? I don't care. Let me just have a conversation with people. So
there's that idea of Buddhist literacy, right? Knowing what you're talking about. So doesn't it, I take a lot of notes. So I would think I'm going to be preparing a lot, at least in the beginning.
Oh, from that point of view. Well, I'm 70 years old and I've been studying Buddhism since 1971. Right?
Yeah.
So, not that there isn't more stuff to learn, but in terms of, Abhidharma, skandhas, the realms, Mahayana models of paramitas, the four immeasurables, all these kinds of things, I've been very fortunate to have studied them for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I don't, the preparation from me is less about mastering certain content. It's really understanding nuance in how to present deeper understandings of those to a modern world. That's where I really, really put in a lot of effort, and I get, overly enthused mm-hmm. by the challenge sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Over this, I mean, that's a lot of time. Do you go back to your notes? How do you, just technical aside, do you like just do the notes in the margins of the books? No. Do you rewrite things for yourself and something and go back?
I have a whole system.
Oh, let me hear it.
it's, you don't necessarily want to do this system.
Yeah, I know, but I want to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have boxes and boxes and boxes of my notes for all the talks I've given. And it's probably several hundred, you know. And the way I do it is I organize in a particular way. But then it goes into an envelope, and the title of the talk is put into on the envelope and a date. And then it's put into a larger envelope, and it's dated. And often they're a sequence talk. So it's like, I don't know, we just did a thing on authentic presence.
Yeah.
It was a series of five talks. That is now organized in a file, and you could go in and see my notes. And,
wow.
And sometimes I don't even, I go back to the notes, I'm like, oh, I don't know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But the way I was trained formally in adult education, there's a whole series of dynamics about how adults learn. So for example, kids don't care, little children don't really care about sequencing. So you could have a bunch of kids here and you go, okay, we're gonna color now. And they go, oh yeah, color. And you go, okay, now we're gonna go outside. And they go, oh yeah, let's go outside. And they don't mind that. That's, adults don't like that. They wanna know where things are going.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, and you know, we're trained in ground, path, and fruition. So the ability to always let the student or whoever you're imparting the information know where you're going is key. So when you organize your talks, you, at least for me, you want to be able to say, let's review where we were last week.
Yeah.
And here's what we'll be covering tonight. That creates a container that for adults, you go, oh, okay, I'm not in a Pilates class. I'm in the right class. So here's another one. And this is something I would really emphasize with people who want to teach Dharma. And if you had my cards here, you'd be looking at the cards, and there's this little box, has LP in the box, and they're everywhere. You know, what's that LP?
What is learning it? Point.
Learning point.
Uh-huh.
You really want to know what your learning point is. And you kind of back out of the learning point. So let's just say, take, for instance, the first paramita of generosity, jhimpa or dana. There's much to say about that. You know, it is that and prajna are the two fundamental paramitas that drive the bodhisattva's love affair with reality, as well as her inclination to increasingly wake up. Those are the two basic engines. Discipline, vigor, meditation, patience, those things sort of, I don't know, they're the meat in the sandwich or something. They're kind of go along with it. So there's a lot to say there. However, what's the learning point? What's the key point? The key point is that for all intents and purposes, generosity or jhimpa is opening. That's the fundamental move, opening unconditionally to the situation on its terms. That is the fundamental gesture of generosity, because you're offering yourself unconditionally to the circumstance in a dualistic arrangement. That takes courage. It takes a broken heart. It takes being vulnerable. All of the dynamics are involved with that simple gesture of opening. Now, if that's your learning point and you know that's where you're going,
mm-hmm.
Well, the story you're going to tell and the points you're going to make getting up there are going to blend into a kind of a dynamic that helps everyone come to that point. So anyway, I don't know if that was...
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And is it sometimes subtext and you're not saying explicitly, this is the main point, or will you often even just say, like, if I saw your notes and it said LP, would you often audibly be saying?
Oh, almost invariably, I make the learning point so I can bring it to that point, you know, except when you're talking about wakefulness. there are certain topics that, you know, you shouldn't try to be explicit about. It's a waste of time.
Oh, that leads right into this other question. Okay. How do you deal with describing something you've read about in the Buddhist canon, but you haven't personally realized?
Well, honestly, I try not to talk about anything that I haven't experienced. However, let me see if I can give an example of this. You give me an example. Give me a topic that you feel that is in a canon that...
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it Bhumi levels?
Bhumis, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. You'll read about one, or you read about one, you're like... And then sometimes I'll see, because he's on YouTube a lot, Dzongtsar Khenpo Rinpoche, we'll talk about one, and they'll say, by the way, I am not there. Yeah. Like, that is... So that's one.
Yeah, okay. So in that case, the first thing that comes to mind is what Trungpa Rinpoche said. He said, in order to go on the Bodhisattva path and reach full enlightenment, the 10th Bhumi or 11th Bhumi, you have to have had a glimpse of the 10th Bhumi. Now, the issue here...
In order to begin on the path?
No, just to travel the path. You will have to have had a glimpse of the full realization of the journey.
Are you saying you wouldn't have even begun if you hadn't had a glimpse?
Or am I saying that's what Trungpa Rinpoche said? I don't know. I don't know if he said you wouldn't have begun.
Okay.
What he did say is you cannot traverse the journey unless you have already glimpsed the goal.
Okay.
Right. So the issue here then, from the point of Bhumis, for me, and I've taught them, is I got to tell you, I don't really care about any Bhumi except for the first one.
Okay.
I don't really care. I don't. If the first Bhumi is joy, which is the freedom of suddenly discovering that you're not locked into a confused mind and that you're awake. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the first one.
Mm-hmm.
If I never even get to the second Bhumi, I'm sure I won't even know, and I don't even care. However, there's this map called the Bhumi map. And let's go and read. Let's go and see what they say is going to happen.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about studying the Bhumis is you begin to notice there's subtle qualities of increasingly letting go of misconception.
Sure.
Well, that sure is a nice little hint. So even the very act of studying it gives you hints as to how one continues to sort of rely on dualistic misunderstanding to give yourself false assurances as you seek to become more authentic, you know, and that's helpful.
Yeah, but so did that just get around to saying you've probably had a little experience of all the things, so there isn't anything you can't teach about?
Kinda, but if someone said give a talk on Bhumis, the first thing I'd say is, excuse me, I don't know much about it. I can go back to my notes. I'm happy to study it and come back and give you the best I can. But I would rather have Dzogchen Rinpoche say a few things.
You know? Well, so in that case, like this is where, I don't have anywhere near the lack of confidence I had when we met. But however, it always is reassuring to me when I read with Ananda, like, thus have I heard. I'm like, I could say that at the top of any talk.
Right.
I might be getting this wrong, but this is how I understand it.
Absolutely. I'll tell you this. I'm being asked to teach Trungpa Rinpoche's Shambhala teachings.
Yeah.
A lot. And, you know, the whole range of it. And I've been saying, and I haven't done a lot of that teaching. I mean, I teach Shambhala, as you well
yeah,
know,
yeah.
But I haven't taught, you know, the execution of the Ashe or even the depth of the Ashe principle. You know, I mean, I have my, but I always say, and I will always say, excuse me, this is my experience. I'm going to give you my experience. I can absolutely guarantee you that there are other teachers who are more experienced, more learned, and more articulate about this. And I encourage you to go and hear from them.
Sounds like marketing material.
I'm going to tell you what my experience is. Yeah. And the only reason why I'm telling you that is because I'm being encouraged to do so. That's it.
Okay. That's relates to, I'm pretty sure you've been leading a talk on something when luckily the person who wrote the book is in the audience, or someone who knows, who might have taught it a lot more or know about it, is right there.
Yeah, that's happened to me
but
a few times.
You still talk very emotively as if you're talking to me or someone who doesn't, maybe hasn't traversed this topic before.
Okay, yeah.
Is that an intentional technique? Because you're talking to different levels of audience.
It's funny. I was thinking that you were pointing to, which is not it, and we'll come back to your topic, is one time I was in Boston giving a talk, and the people in the room were serious dudes and dudettes. I mean, these were, you know, the head of Children's Hospital and a lot of physicians and scientists. I don't know how they all got there, but it was pretty cool. I was quite impressed with the conversations we were having. There was about 20 people. In any case, I quoted some data from a mindfulness experiment on the immune system. And I basically said something about more white blood cells to actually resist the flu. And I said it, excuse me. I actually did that experiment and wrote the research on that. And it isn't that you got, that you could resist the flu more. You can't say that. You can say that you have far more white blood cells that actually those are designed to resist the flu, but you can't say that they actually resist the flu. So it was kind of interesting having that person in the room, and I'm there, you know, the guy was the guy who did the experiment. It was kind of funny. Anyway, back to this. I'm not particularly, when you say, when I'm trying to impart an insight into, let's say, the Abhidharma, let's say the structure of ego's misunderstanding of identity, for example, there may be someone in the room who would have a better understanding of that or be able to impart it even more skillfully. And I hope in my heart that I create an environment where they're invited to do so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but are you thinking of the audience when you're coming up with the structure of the course? You know, level one kind of thing, someone's never been here.
Right.
You're like, what's a bodhisattva? And you might talk about it in some way, rather than if you're like talking to senior practitioners about some more subtle aspect of it.
No.
But you'll find in some of the classes, they're all there. So it might be like, well, this was a beginner class, but this person I've known for 45 years happens to be here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's a good question because...
Fine.
Because teaching mindfulness awareness in sort of conventional settings or in sort of broad settings, not sort of a group of Buddhists who are from a particular lineage or are here for the retreat to study a particular body of teachings or something like that. I've been in settings where I have to teach mindfulness awareness to a group of people, and there's a person in the room that has heard the word mindfulness somewhere. And simultaneously, there's a couple people who have been doing mindfulness for 20 years. They're in the same room. And that's happened to me a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the territory of wanting to impart these teachings in secular settings. I personally find that fun.
Okay.
Because it requires me to come up mostly with metaphors that invite shared wisdom.
Oh, that's good. That's like what you said at the beginning.
Yeah, that it can be inclusive about being human.
Yeah.
Whether you are already have experienced even being awake or having just the smell of it in the room, there are certain shared dynamics being human or authentic that can be enlivened through a metaphor. Metaphors are important. They're actually central to imparting teachings.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And plus, hopefully the people who've been doing it for 20 years aren't particularly annoyed if they're like, I've heard this before.
Yeah, well, no, now you're getting to something that freaks me out all the time, because I tell, you know, like that, you're familiar with the story of the CFO who's looking at the watch.
Yeah, that's right. Good. Now,
I've told that story way too much, but I feel somewhat embarrassed. I don't know why, but I feel embarrassed telling the same story again, because I don't want to take advantage of people's attention. You know, they're here to have a unique and fresh conversation, and I don't want to go over old territory. However, you know, I won't name the teacher, but a pretty big name. If I said the name, you'd be like, oh, that's a big teacher.
Yeah.
And there's like 500 people in the room, blah, 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 blah. And the person tells a story. And I go, man, that's a great story. Afterwards, I said, that's a great story. And the person looks at me and goes, she's told that story, 600 times. I mean, she's been telling that for years. You know, and I was like, oh, okay. So
it's fresh for somebody.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, and also if you look at the history of spiritual, imparting spiritual stories, I mean, teachings, telling the story over and over again is not an unusual dynamic. You know, the one that I love is that Taoist story of the kid and the lion, the tiger, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I've told that story many a times. I think I have a unique slant on it, a bit of a unique slant. But that story has been told probably several million times over the past, 4,000 years? You know, I think it was a Taoist song, story that was 1500 BC or something.
Can we do a little on like these couple of terms here? So for someone like me, right, who's starting this, there's this term spiritual friend.
Yeah.
Then there's someone who's a Buddhist teacher. I assume that is the same as Dharma teacher, 180. There's this guy, Gary Vee, who does a lot of marketing. And he talks about like things you can do. And he's got two phrases and they both work for me. One is document, don't create. Which is like document the process you're working on rather than always waiting till you got something and putting it out there. And then another one, he's like, you can be an enthusiast. You don't have to be an expert.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that actually relates to this of like, hey, everyone, I promise I'm going to do a bunch of research. I'm going to read a lot of things. And then I'm going to have this talk and these learning points. But I consider that we're exploring this topic together. Yeah. This is not me telling you how it is.
Yeah, I would say a few things here. One is, I have no doubt in my mind that where the imparting of dharmic disciplines, practices, models, concepts is going is more orchestrating than imparting. How do you orchestrate a conversation? How do you orchestrate insight? How do you invite vulnerability? How do you create an atmosphere where people feel that expressing their authenticity is wholesome? That's where teaching is going. I do believe that the history of Buddhist teaching, and I think generally spiritual teaching, is an elder imparting her wisdom to those who are seeking to deepen their understanding. And, you know, that's been happening for thousands of years, you know, tens of thousands of years. And that's a worthy relationship with a teacher, no doubt about it. But I'm sensing that that's changing given how human beings kind of shape their relationships with one another, social intelligence, and learn from one another. And I would encourage any Buddhist teacher to perfect those skills of orchestrating wisdom rather than imparting it. And that's a much more challenging, I believe, a much more challenging set of skills. However, now what happens there is it changes the role of the teacher. And as you know, I've said to you before, I don't really like being called a teacher.
Right.
And the reason being is I feel that that relationship teacher to student, well, I am so honored by my teachers. You know, I would, they are teachers.
Got
I am a student.
Yeah. You know?
And that goes back to, you know, when I was in high school, I had a German teacher who was so, he didn't teach me German, he taught me philosophy and logic. And I mean, that was a formative thing. So it's not just Dharma teachers, it's teachers generally is a very respected role in my life. And I will never forget that. However, I find that as a teacher, working with someone like you, the title teacher and the title student often more confuses the circumstances rather than clarifying them. You know, and I'm not even sure what the best way to do it is. And I think that speaks to what I'm talking about, the orchestration of wisdom rather than I have the goodies. Now, obviously, some people who get to know me go, dude, how'd you say that? Where'd that come from? You know, and I get that. And, you know, and other people have their strengths and areas. And so therefore people want to understand how I parsed a particular insight. And, and I have no problem with that. But the issue of being a teacher from the point of view of orchestrating is then you begin to notice that you teach in ways that you maybe didn't know about. Right? So there's two men, for example, who the way they teach is circumstantial.
Yeah.
They get into circumstances that you and I would never get in, and they impart. They transmit wisdom in circumstances. They inspire the best in others spiritually at very interesting points in the way they navigate their world. Mm-hmm. That is very potent way of teaching. And I think we really need to broaden our definition of what it means to teach. And it has to do with influencing the world in a way that provokes sanity and kindness. I remember, I don't know if this will make it in, but I remember I love Wan Buddhism.
Wan, yeah, Korean.
Buddhism. I just have so much respect for them. And I got to know them over many years. I would teach at their school and all that kind of stuff. And the monks there were so, the monks and the nuns are so fresh and so naive in the best sense of the term. And they would come to me and they go, you know, how do you bring these teachings? We want to bring these teachings into modern world. But how do you do it? And I said, well, you know, because Trungpa Rinpoche helped us do it, you know.
Yeah.
And how do you people in Shambhala do this so well? I said, you know, you really should just sort of relate with people on their terms and get to know how they speak. And they said, like where? I said, like, where do you buy your coffee? Or where? He said, well, there's a grocery store down there. I said, well, there you go. Yeah, cashier, you know. They all went down and started relating with cashiers. They came back and they said, okay, we went down and we met with the cashiers.
They
literally went and met with cashiers. It was so sweet. It was just so, and they came to my level one and Master Han came to my level one and stuff. But it was just so, it really made me fall in love with them, you know. But the point is the melody of circumstance invites us to impart the teachings all the time. And I think I think going forward for Buddhist teachers, we need to attend to that reality that it's an orchestration of wisdom and a melody of circumstances that invite us to provoke the best in others, basically, mm-hmm. the wakefulness in others.
This is great. This sounds like a very like personal, intimate knowledge of how I or you or anyone would see themselves as imparting teachings to people. But we also have a website and we put things on there. And there's one part that says meditation instructors, right? could that be swapped for Buddhist teachers? Do you see these as different roles?
Yeah, I do. I see them as different roles. And the reason why I see it as different roles is because the way Trungpa Rinpoche trained me and others in the Shambhala vision. And one of the core elements of Shambhala vision is that culture, by definition, is healthy, can be healthy. And it doesn't have to be Buddhist culture. It can be Christian culture.
Mm-hmm.
It can be, you know, like nature culture, you know, or just sports culture. It can, culture is, can be healthy. And therefore, inflicting Buddhist culture on culture is questionable. Not that, you know, both of us love Buddhism and happy to teach it to people. And, you know, I'm not ashamed of being, tell people I'm a Buddhist by any means. However, the idea of meditation is being able to help all human beings realize the inherent wakefulness of their lives on their terms, not ours. So I think meditation teacher is the better title.
Yeah, okay. So going along with those terms, how do you, where does lineage holder fit in?
Yeah.
How is it the same or different from these others?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a very interesting and spicy question.
Ooh, all right.
Yeah, spicy. There's an essay, and you may want to follow up and get the
link.
Yeah, yeah. I'll put it in where some people can go. It's written by a lama, a woman lama, who is a scholar, whose name is slipping my mind, but that's happening to me a lot when I'm 70. But nonetheless, what she does in this essay is she goes back to this point where Gampopa, I think I've spoken to you about this before, where Gampopa is the holder of both the formless Mahamudra style, and he's also received the tantric Mahamudra style from Milarepa, and Milarepa's gone. And now Gampopa is the, quote, lineage holder, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of, you can literally get a couple of the books, I've read them, they're translated, where Rektumpa and other cave dwellers come down to speak with, they speak to Gampopa. And you know, the audience is going to go, dude, that's not what happened, you know. But nonetheless, I'm going to tell it my own way. And basically, as I read it, they go, "Dude, what are we going to do, man? You have the formless style, and we also do the tantric sadhana style. What do we do? How do we do this?" And Gampopa kind of goes, "I don't know." So, and he goes, "Well, why don't we try this?" And he goes, start with going, when you go in retreat, because these men and women wanted to go back to their caves and practice. And he said, okay, what you do is you start off with guru yoga, and then, then you do your sadhana practice, and then, then you do a long period you take a refuge vow, that was the beginning, and then you do a long period of formless meditation. And you end the day by dedicating merit. Try that. And everyone's like, copied. Okay. And they go off. And that now became the Gampopa's five-point Mahamudra instruction. But the impression that I read in the translation was it was just them sitting there going, I don't know, what do we do? But why am I telling that story is at that time, the men and women who started practicing and mingling those two forms of Mahamudra, they were not in their mind saying, I'm creating a lineage.
Mm-hmm.
They were just doing what they were being instructed to do to sort it out. And in retrospect, it created the four great and eight lesser lineages, Drikung, Taklang, Salpa, these, you know, and the great one, Karmakatsang, which is the Karmapa line, right? But none those people, according to the scholar, and I think she has it right, they weren't like, I'm now a lineage holder and I'm creating a lineage.
Right.
It was an organic expression of devotion and discipline and realization that moved through. And that she uses the word streaming, that lineage in Tibetan means stream. And the way streams are created, and I remember seeing this, it was so cool. I was coming out of Tibet, and when you come down to Chengdu, you come through Kham and into Sichuan, and it comes down. And I'll never forget this. We're coming off the plateau, and it's early in the morning. I'm in this bus, and I can see it right now. It's like this long, flat plateau that goes down. It's going down really, really, really far. And it's like, you know, way, way down there. And the road goes like this. Oh. Because you can't go straight down. Mm-hmm. And the bus just keeps going back and forth. And it's foggy. Oh. There's clouds everywhere. You're in a cloud. It's like foggy. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there looking out the window. And I'm noticing that the wet on the ground, because the plateau is only a little grass, about that much, it forms little rivulets. Just little teeny rivulets from the cloud. And then they start forming into little teeny streams. And then the road has to have little pipes for the water to go through it. And by the time we get down there, there's a giant river. Mm. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
This is the point she's making, is that those streams, some of them come together to form a lineage, while others maybe just peter out. They use a little water kind of thing. She also makes a very important distinction between a sect and a lineage. Lineage inclines to an organic expression of a body of experiences and realizations in such a way that inspires others to do it, and they pass it on, and it becomes a momentum. Whereas a sect seeks to define itself as having a unique body of teachings that distinguish them from others in a way that they consider potentially superior or sufficiently different in such a way as to distinguish them in a positive light or in a unique light that makes them sort of more sought after, right? Mm. Building a sect, I honestly, for me personally, I don't really care. I could, at this point, because I think that's where we are right now. Trungpa Rinpoche and other lamas, Dzogchen Rinpoche, Karmapa, and many of the young lamas like Zangso Kensei and others right now, they bridged Tantric Buddhism from a 2,000-year-old medieval, not that long, but since 1600, they've bridged it into modern society just like that, like in 30, 40, 50 years. And you and I are the inheritors of that.
Yeah.
And the issue is, okay, just like Gampopa was saying to the cave dwellers, well, what are you going to do? And you and I are like, I don't know. What are we going to do? I got to go to work. I got kids. So we're in the process of creating lineages, is what I'm saying. That isn't a credential. It's just reality.
Yeah, not a credential. When I was thinking about how to try to explain it to myself, of like being, like when you said to me, not just me, but like, I consider you lineage holders. Mm-hmm. I'm not a military person, but I always pictured it kind of like, you get off, you're in World War II, right? You're an infantry person, and you get there, and you're part of this group. And you're charging, like going through the woods, and you find a soldier that's just been shot. You don't know this person. You're leaning over, and then they hand you, it's one of two things. They hand you a letter. They're like, you have to give this to my wife. Right. And then they die. Right. And you're like, you have this precious thing. It's a massive responsibility. You didn't particularly ask for it, but you're gonna take care of it. That's one.
That's a perfect metaphor.
Or
go on.
You're given, or they're not giving you that. They're giving you. They're giving you like the plans.
A map.
This is better. Right. Like this is the map to where the whole team has to get to. You're the only one that has it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got it. You have to. And it's. I look at it as almost like medicine. You've been handed the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where samaya comes in, right? That when you are willing to have that relationship with the immediacy of primordial reality and be introduced to it and understand how simple and effortless that relationship is, the medicine, the samaya vow is to never, ever underestimate or sort of take for granted the power of your responsibility, ever. If you take it for granted, just even, oh yeah, you're going to get hit with lightning. Because this is medicine that all beings, that the universe inclines and yearns to impart to all sentient beings, that it's waking up. It wants to wake up completely, you know? And so I think that's a great metaphor. And guess what? I just stole it.
Okay.
And we'll be using it.
Copyright. That's great. My last question is, what should I have asked? The topic was generally, to me, you've been seen as a meditation instructor and a Buddhist teacher for a long time. Mm-hmm. And now in our organization here, not just you, but others are helping those of us who've been around a while also be empowered to do that, become mm-hmm. Buddhist teachers, teach in different ways. So a lot of people put a lot of time and work into me, so I shouldn't just keep that. I should like share that in some way. So that's the topic, is like how to start sharing this, helping others more generally, being willing to stand up and, okay, I'll teach something that I've learned.
Yeah, I think for you,
not just me.
No, but I'm going to say.
Sure.
I think that the podcast approach you are sort of going to, which is an orchestration of voices, insights, I think you really need to lean into that as a teaching style.
Great.
As a teaching style. But don't let it give you the impression that it doesn't require you to study really hard. Mm-hmm. You should, in your lifetime, master the content of the Buddhist teachings. Not every text. I mean, that would be ridiculous.
Sorry.
But, you know, just in terms of Abhidharmic understanding, you should be well-schooled in the Abhidharma. In terms of the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva vow, and the various kind of subtleties of expressing the awakened state through the paramitas, four immeasurables, 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, et cetera, et cetera, you should know them very, very well and work with them, and then let them soak into you, so that when you're having an interview, You remember something like drive all blames into one, and you say, you know, what do you do when people accuse you of really weird shit, man? You know, that happens on the internet all the time now, and they just make up stuff. How do you feel? Right? That comes from understanding drive all blames into one versus a conventional notion of fuck them. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, my point is you should have this almost organically nonchalant style of orchestrating voices, but behind the scenes should be a very muscular understanding of the Dharma.
Okay. That works. Yeah. That's good.
Good.
Thank you. That's for me. Anything else at all?
I don't know where this is going. You know, I want to be dead by the time this gets clear. Trungpa Rinpoche was on to something. I think you might have noticed that. Which is, where Buddhism is going in the West is more about provoking the inherent sanity of the West than imparting sanity to it.
Yeah.
There's a quote that you may want to get from Matt DeRodio. He sent it to me. It was from, I forget the name of the gentleman, Jigme Funsak, I forget. He was the gentleman who started the Larung Gar in Tibet, a very famous gathering of thousands of practitioners. Anyway, when he came to the West, His first thing was, there's five, and you get the quote, there are five Pure Lands. And he named them. He goes, one of them was Shambhala. It's one of the Pure Lands. And he goes, now that I've come to the West, I now see that this is the second Shambhala. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how do you work with the fact that the kingdom is hidden in plain sight?
Right.
How do you work with the fact that this is a pure land that has gone mad? So, it's your job. Figure it out. Don't mess it up.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this discussion with Michael Carroll. I hope you picked up that orchestrating insight versus imparting knowledge, that's the way to go. I'll be putting in the show notes here the links that Michael talked about and the quotes that he referenced. I hope you found this insightful. Please consider subscribing to the podcast if you like it, and visit us at thewisdomseat.org. Take care.